The Federal Reserve is just like the rest of us. It bought too much stuff, and now it has to purge. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In San Francisco, I'm Molly Wood, in for Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday, June 15th, and we're glad to be with you. Let's get started with a little more context from yesterday's Federal Reserve announcement. One of the things Janet Yellen talked about was the Fed's balance sheet, the list of all the assets it owns. That sheet is huge. $4.5 trillion worth of mainly treasuries and bonds. It used to be less than a trillion. The plan, like with a giant credit card balance, is to slowly shrink that down a few $1 billion a month, starting sometime soon. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore has the goods on that.
Back during the recession, the Fed did what it usually does when things are bad. It lowered short-term interest rates for an economy that's like pushing on the gas pedal. The Fed did this again and again and again, and eventually...
And the Fed lowered that rate to essentially zero.
Gabriel Chodorow-Reich is a professor of economics at Harvard, and still the economy was in very bad shape. So around that time, the Fed thought, well, what else can we do?
So what the Fed thought is it could help stimulate purchases.
Maybe it could get people to buy more cars and homes, for example. What might help? How about making car loans and mortgages, long-term loans, cheaper? Joe Gagnon is with the Peterson Institute and used to work for the Fed.
The Fed steps in and buys up a lot of mortgage bonds or government bonds.
The Fed walked right into the bond market and started gobbling up long-term bonds. It said, we'll buy bonds even if they have low interest rates. No problem. We'll even pay more for them. In a way, they created a market for lower interest rate bonds, eventually making it cheaper for people to take out car loans or mortgages. The Fed spent trillions doing this. Now it has a giant pile of bonds.
And as they mature, the Fed has been sort of like rebuying them again.
Scott Sumner is with the Mercatus Center, but the Fed has said that soon it's going to stop rebuying these bonds.
What the Fed is going to do is stop rolling them over. So as the bonds mature, their balance sheet will naturally tend to decline.
So what happens is the bonds mature, and like for any bondholder, the Treasury pays the Fed the value of the bond plus interest. The Fed takes that money and just vaporizes it, deletes it into thin air. Poof. It's going to happen pretty slowly, so most economists don't see it as being disruptive.
To be honest, this is not going to probably have a dramatic effect on the economy.
Or, as Janet Yellen said, it's going to be like watching paint dry. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Nike announced today it will cut 2% of its global workforce, or about 1,400 employees. I was surprised, considering how much I've spent on retro Jordans lately. But athletic footwear sales are slowing, especially in retail. That's according to NPD Group. Oregon-based Nike says the layoffs are part of a restructuring plan and a new focus on big city markets like Shanghai, LA, and Mexico City. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman kicks this one around. Yeah, we did that.
First, it's important to acknowledge there have been a lot of challenges lately on the field of play for the world's leading athletic brands.
The sporting goods industry for a decade has not been what we'd call a robust retail sector.
David Schick at Consumer Edge Research says the recession depressed consumer spending and high-end sneakers can be pretty pricey. Then last year, Sports Authority went bankrupt. Other chains have been closing stores nationwide. Still, Nike kept growing with strong sales overseas and powerful branding in performance sneakers. But lately, upstart competitor Under Armour has come on strong. And analyst Jonathan Komp at Robert W. Baird & Company says German rival Adidas has eye-catching colorful styles that have grabbed the fancy of consumers.
More fashion athletic and more of a casual athletic and even incorporating retro styles.
Nike's response? Winnowing down its styles by 25% and focusing on high-end experiential flagship stores around the world. And John Horan, publisher of Sporting Goods Intelligence, says like Adidas, Nike is developing digital tools to customize shoes for consumers.
You would walk into a store and they're going to scan your foot and they're going to have you run on a force plate and they're going to create a digital file that will fit you exactly.
Horan says ultimately Nike wants to get to a place where it doesn't need stores and malls or on main streets, and it can sell a customized sneaker directly to anyone online. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
For-profit colleges have come under attack lately, but they might be getting a break from the Trump administration. Education Secretary Betsy DeVos announced she plans to roll back two Obama-era regulations, one rule that made the colleges prove that students could make enough money after graduation to pay for their degrees. The other let students have their federal loans forgiven if their for-profit college went bust. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams has more.
The argument is that while these two rules were supposed to help students, the process was off. Matt Friendaway worked with DeVos at the Department of Education until recently and is now an independent consultant.
Both of them were put in place in an ad hoc process. And what the secretary announced is really creating a open and transparent process to allow public input, which is the way that things are supposed to be done.
A rewriting of the rules may create more opportunity for the for-profit college industry to weigh in. Thomas Bailey, who studies the for-profits at Columbia University's Community College Research Center, says the gainful employment rule is a particular target.
I mean, many for-profit certificate programs were sanctioned under gainful employment, and so those would be lifted.
Many are concerned delaying or revamping these rules will strip away student protections.
Borrowers are the ones who are really going to suffer here.
Claire McCann is with the New America Foundation and worked at education during the Obama administration.
It seems that we've turned a new page in terms of accountability for poor performing colleges, and I think for-profit colleges particularly stand to benefit from that.
But none of this is likely to happen quickly. The regulatory process is slow, and it's unlikely we'll get new rules on these issues until late next year at the earliest. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, a little indigestion as traders digested this week's Fed moves and the tech sector continued its sell-off. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Yeah, those tech stocks may be having trouble today, but let's talk about the device that made Apple must-own stock, and depending on the day, the most valuable publicly traded company in the world. Later this month will be the 10-year anniversary of the iPhone, and a new book coming out next week chronicles some of the untold stories of the iPhone's birth, a super-secret project in the mid-2000s, vanishing engineers, and an internal battle over whose vision for the new Apple phone would take off. We all know the story after that. Brian Merchant has the backstory. His book is called The One Device, The Secret History of the iPhone. Hi, Brian. Thanks for joining me.
Hi, Molly. Thanks so much for having me.
So what a fascinating story, especially for some of us who may have been covering tech for quite a while.
Yeah, thank you.
Let's start at the top, I guess. How is the development of the iPhone different than the development of anything, any other computer that Apple had done, the iMac or something like that?
Well, at the point when the designers and engineers started to really think about the interaction paradigm, which is really kind of ultimately what sets the iPhone apart, which is that it's based on multi-touch and you're touching. And there weren't a lot of consumer-facing touchscreens out at the time. So they were really kind of answering this question of how do we, you know, want to interact with our devices?
Well, and it sounds like internally, at least at this sort of time of birth, there were a couple of competing teams working on things, right? You had sort of Tony Fadell's iPod-based model, and then you had what Steve Jobs wanted, which was a smaller tablet. Is that a fair characterization?
Yeah. So it was this experimental project that was kind of waiting in the wings, but they decided that it just was too expensive, so they kind of put it on hold. And then the iPod took off, and there was this business imperative that said, okay, well, cell phones are getting smarter too, and pretty soon people are going to be able to put music on their cell phones. So they were really worried about this prospect of kind of cell phones eating the iPod's lunch. So they decided to do one themselves. And then at the time, the obvious answer was slap a phone onto the iPod. But in the development process, they really ran into a bunch of hurdles because it turns out it's really hard to make calls with a rotary click wheel.
Is that what are some of the other reasons why that multi-touch approach, the sort of Steve Jobs vision, won out?
Well, you know, you had a bunch of really smart people who had been working together for a really long time, once they saw, you know, this interaction paradigm where, wait a second, we can touch computers, we can play with data with our hand, we can do direct manipulation, as they called it, they said, you know what, we can turn this into a mobile computer. So they basically kind of took that up, and it started looking like this really compelling, really exciting way to make a phone. And once the click wheel didn't work, they kind of had this famous meeting where they were like, you know what, there's one of these two projects that we really want to do, and it's pretty clear that this is the one that excites people, and so let's just do it.
So tell me, you know, what was life like for the engineers working on this project?
Well,
in 30 seconds or less, how miserable are we talking here?
Let's say very unpleasant. I've had it described as a soup of misery. A lot of F-bombs were dropped. It was chaos. It was round the clock. Only the people with security clearance could get in, and that meant very little got out, including, you know, dirty laundry and, you know, trash. So the trash was piling up. It stunk. You know, there were shouting matches and slam doors, and it really was intense.
All right, and so then the iPhone comes out. It's obviously so influential in the cell phone market. If Apple had not made this phone, if they had not gone in this direction with multi-touch and all of these interface kind of designs, what do you think? Can you speculate on what you think phones might look like now?
Oh, man. It's just so ubiquitous. We take it for granted. We see a screen without a keyboard. We assume we can touch, swipe, prod, poke it. If it hadn't gone with multi-touch, you know, maybe we'd all have these little tiny keyboards that we'd still be getting arthritis in our hands early from pecking away on, you know? It's really hard to speculate.
Brian Merchant is author of a book called One Device, The Secret History of the iPhone, that is due out next Tuesday. Brian, thanks so much for your time.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Earlier this spring, a house exploded in Colorado, killing two people. The explosion was caused by gas leaking out of an underground pipeline that had been accidentally cut. The April incident has rocked Colorado's oil and gas industry and renewed a bitter debate about drilling in urban areas. From Colorado Public Radio, Ben Marcus reports.
This is what authorities say happened. For 3 months, natural gas from an old but still active well ran through an uncapped pipeline. It seeped through the soil and into the basement of a home in the city of Firestone, 30 miles north of Denver. When the gas finally ignited, the home was leveled, and two men inside were killed. A couple of years earlier, the city of Firestone filmed this promotional video. The former mayor talks up the innovative schools and low tax rates.
And we have abundant land and infrastructure ready for development. When you consider all of these things, it's no wonder that the U.S. Census Bureau found that Firestone was the fastest growing community in Colorado over the past decade.
One important thing that isn't mentioned, the landscape is filled with oil and gas wells, many connected through a web of underground pipelines. Sam Mamet is with the Colorado Municipal League, which lobbies on behalf of cities. He says cities have to grow as the state's population balloons, and Colorado's 54,000 active oil and gas wells aren't going anywhere.
Well, that's just the sobering reality of the situation, and no one can really change that ostensibly unless they just want to impose growth moratoria in these communities, and that is not likely to occur.
And many Colorado cities like Firestone are maximizing their precious land. The home that was destroyed was just half a football field away from a 30-year-old well. Anadarko Petroleum, the owner of the well, says it's cooperating with federal and local investigators, and the company's being sued by nearby homeowners for loss of value to their homes. Matt Lepore is Colorado's top oil and gas regulator. He argues that he can't restrict where homes are built. And when the state limited fracking to 500 feet from homes, he got an urgent call from an official at a fast-growing city.
He wanted my absolute reassurance that if we had a 500-foot setback, he could still approve residential building within 200 feet of the well. And I said, yes, sir, that is the way the law works.
Besides, he says the proximity to the well was not necessarily the problem in the Firestone explosion. It was the proximity to what was believed to be an abandoned flow line. These lines are supposed to end at tanks which collect the gas and can stretch far from producing wells.
If the line ends 6 feet from the basement foundation and gas flows through it, you're going to have a problem.
So, to some, restricting where homes can be built next to wells makes no sense. Gregory Miedema runs the Northern Colorado Home Builders Association. He says builders need to be able to put houses on as much land as they can to make the numbers work. Otherwise,
increased setbacks, reduced density, higher home costs because they're not making any more land.
He says people are moving to these fast-growing outer suburbs to escape Denver's high housing costs. A three-bedroom home in Firestone will run you about $350,000. In Denver, it can be double that. Matt Sura, an environmental attorney, says his focus has always been on restricting where new wells are put because those are the bigger, noisier, more intense operations. When it comes to the state's legacy of existing wells,
unfortunately, the die is cast. We've got so many oil and gas wells that are sprinkled throughout these communities that we're going to have to figure out a way to coexist.
By creating, he says, tougher regulations and adding more inspections to ensure safety. In Denver, I'm Ben Marcus for Marketplace.
Coming up,
I know this makes me sound like such a language fuss budget.
It is Twitter versus the Queen's English. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 14 points, less than a 10%, to end at 21,359. The NASDAQ lost 29 points, 0.4%, to close at 61.65. The S&P 500 was off 5 points, 0.2%, to finish at 24.32. Supermarket chain Kroger gave up 18.8%. It reported weak first quarter sales and cut its profit forecast amid keen competition on pricing. Competitor Walmart knocked off 1.25%. Costco slimmed 0.8%. We told you retail was tough. Sportswear giant Nike slowed 3.2%. You heard earlier that the company is cutting some 1,400 jobs and reducing its range of sneaker styles by a quarter. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.16%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Hi, everybody. It's Kai Rizdahl. Marketplace is here because these days it's essential to have an independent source explaining how the economy really works, not just for CEOs, but for everybody. Your support keeps this kind of reporting coming, and it's especially vital now at the end of our fiscal year. So please visit marketplace.org/donate to contribute and to keep us in your world every day. And thanks.
This is Marketplace. I'm Molly Wood. The Trump administration has made a big deal out of prioritizing coal jobs. Back in March, President Trump signed an executive order to roll back climate change efforts, and he was surrounded by coal industry workers. He told them that they would soon be going back to work. And more recently, EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt celebrated the number of coal jobs created since Trump took office. But there appears to be some confusion about how many of those jobs there are and how many there aren't. Marketplace's Scott Tong is here to explain. Hey, Scott.
Hey, Molly.
All right. So EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt has been talking up all of these added coal jobs, saying that the U.S. has added 50,000 jobs in the coal sector. He later took a fair amount of heat for that statement. Is it true?
Well, he took a lot of heat for it, perhaps because of the magnitude of how misleading that number is. You see, the Labor Department says we have 51,000 coal mining jobs in the country total, but not increased, total. Now, Scott Pruitt later kind of corrected himself, suggesting that he meant the broader mining sector, for which coal mining is a tiny sliver. So here's the actual number. About 1,000 coal mining jobs, according to the Labor Department, have been added since January. So that's 1,000 jobs in an economy that often adds 150,000 jobs every month, right? I mean, we have fewer coal miners than workers at Disney World in the U.S. Wow. at this point. Now, sometimes the jobs blip up and down. This is a commodity sector that's volatile. But the longer story is an unmistakable kind of century-long decline in coal jobs. I went recently, Molly, to coal country in southern Illinois and western Kentucky. And every single person I spoke to in the industry there, they said, we know we're not getting back to where we were as far as coal jobs. We're just trying to halt the decline. So that's the real picture.
So let's talk a little bit about that decline. First of all, why have coal jobs been in decline, and particularly recently?
Well, in the last 5 years alone, America's coal jobs have fallen almost by half. So there are a few big things going on here. We have coal being replaced by other fuels in the system. Natural gas is cheaper in much of the country, and renewable energy is desired by policies in 29 states. So that's one big piece of it. And a much smaller piece of the story, according to a recent study, is regulation. We have clean air rules limiting pollutants like sulfur and mercury, and those go back to the first Bush administration. And I should say, hardly any of what we're talking about has to do with carbon climate rules that haven't even kicked in yet at the federal level. And we know this administration is trying to undo those. Now, here, briefly, is the longer story, Molly. A century ago, we had 800,000 coal miners. But then, you know, coal-powered steam engine trains gave way to cars and transportation. That is coal being replaced by oil. And then coal for heating got replaced by electricity. So these are big, big energy generational trends that we're seeing here, Molly.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, but so why then is there so much kind of political currency? If the historical trend line is so clear, why is there so much political currency to this coal miner story? Why are we talking about, you know, 51,000 jobs?
It's a powerful story. I mean, many towns in the U.S., you know, once upon a time were literally built on coal by grandparents, grandfathers who came to the States from Eastern Europe to make a life, right? Miners today are still heroes. They're the strongest, bravest men in town who take on some of the most dangerous work underground in many places. So when something is lost, right, I mean, there's evidence from behavioral science that the pain of losing something is actually twice as strong as the pleasure of gaining something. So there's something about what some call the salience of loss. And we see very clearly, more broadly, kind of in the labor market, that we look in the rearview mirror and we know the jobs that we're losing. You know, even though we're all always creating new jobs, it's less clear what those new jobs are going to be. And that's always the challenge.
That's Marketplace's Scott Tong. Scott, thanks so much.
Okay, you're welcome.
In this age of Twitter and texting, life can be taxing for people who enjoy specificity and precision when it comes to language. And I don't just mean me. Here's humorist and writer Jenny Allen.
Would everybody please stop using these words and phrases that are a novelty one minute and the next minute in total overuse? Oh, so many things bother me about the word deplane, I have to say. First of all, that it's a word, that it seems to have replaced exit the plane or get off the plane or, yeah, exit. So the airline industry came up with this word because it just sounds more important and a more serious thing, perhaps, than just getting off the plane. And then it really bothered me that people, ordinary citizens like you and me, started using it. Like, we don't have to say that, but we then have adopted the phrases that the flight attendants and the pilot use. Ooh, big pharma. Why can't people just say big pharmaceutical companies? It's just not that many more syllables. Like, it's not that hard for your mouth to make the rest of the syllables, it feels like to me. Everybody sort of leaps on these things, and then they get tiresome. I know this makes me sound like such a language fuss budget, a career I never thought I would have, but I guess I am getting crankier as I get older.
That was Jenny Allen, who I love, with a selection from her new book, Would Everybody Please Stop? Reflections on Life and Other Bad Ideas. This final note before we go, Pulitzer Prize winner Tracy K. Smith has been named America's 22nd Poet Laureate. She said her mission will be to make poetry more accessible to people all over America. She told CNN that poetry brings hope. Now, as it happens, Smith wrote a commentary for us back in 2013 about what hope means to her. Here's what she said.
I think how used we've gotten to the symbols of action and how far those symbols sit from action itself. Like us on Facebook. And we do. We most certainly do. Then we scroll ahead and disappear back into our private lives. But the hope I'm talking about isn't a symbol. It sits well beneath the surface of language and requires us to unravel what we say, to decode what we are routinely told, to verify what we are only just beginning to think. Moreover, it requires us to keep at it, to remain awake to the world.
That was Tracy K. Smith, our new U.S. Poet Laureate. She won the Pulitzer Prize for Life on Mars in 2012. All right, we got to go. Today, the Dow fell 14 points, the NASDAQ lost 29 points, and the S&P 500 was off 5 points, that 0.2%. John Buckley, Deirdre Depke, Eve Epstein, Danielle Irby, Suzanne Levy, Betsy Streisand, and Eve Tro are the Marketplace editing staff. Our interim managing editor is John Gordon. I'm Molly Wood. We'll see you all tomorrow. This is APM.